always been a joy to fellowship with them in the brief times we've had. We had the very special privilege of visiting them in their home. What a unique experience to find them in the province of Rondônia. Is that close to how you pronounce it? Looks like Rondônia, but it's Rondônia. And was an area of Brazil that early in their time in Brazil was opened up for homesteading kinds of venture. It was a frontier area of Brazil in the time. And they were there as ministry of the missionary church and touching lives there. And church planting and over time, Ron and Jeanette have been absolutely key in training other ministers and have really established a Brazilian kind of seminary that's possible in the mostly rural area that they live in, and have given their lives to developing and training through a seminary program that operates really out of their home and furthers the ministry of pastors while they are continuing to pastor. And so they have been pioneers in ministry, and they are at this age category where they're looking for God's direction into the future. So I don't know if they're going to comment about that, but we can be praying with them about that. Ron and Jeanette were so much in our prayers quite a number of years ago when Ron, in a motorcycle accident, was paralyzed and has been in a wheelchair ever since, somewhat parallel to Charlie Warner. Their accidents happened within months of each other, and I've been able to just chat with each of them a little bit about that. But the ministry that Ron and Jeanette have carried on under those circumstances has been phenomenal, and it's a privilege to be associated with them. It's a privilege to have you here today with us. Bless you as you have been faithful in serving the Lord and seeking God's will into the future. And so we're going to have a couple ushers come and just help Ron up onto the platform. And actually, three of our biggest guys are going to come. Ron, you're in great hands. And Jeanette is also going to be part of this presentation. And we look forward to it very much. It's great fun to watch Ron balance just on two wheels. Right there you go. Tremendous. God bless you as you share with us.
Well, thank you so much. I remember being at the Missionary Church of Canada's General Conference in Calgary. I think it was in 1990. Before it was the Evangelical Missionary Church of Canada, and Pastor David Krause was handing out papers to conference members. When he came to me, he realized that I need both hands to do anything or go anywhere, and he said, "Now when would it be convenient for me to give you these papers?" Not very many people in that sort of a position think of those sorts of things, and I've always remembered that, David, and appreciate it. And, of course, very special when you and Karen were with us in Brazil. Being back so close to Dixon's Hill brings back all kinds of memories. I'm going to follow my script pretty closely here tonight, or this morning. We're just doing this for the first time this time over. The first year I taught at Markham High School, the area churches held an evangelistic campaign with Ken Campbell in the Stouffville Arena. I spent the day at Markham High trying to keep slightly ahead of my grade 9 and 10 students in history and geography. The evenings at Stouffville Arena, and most of the night trying to get ready for classes the next day. Saturday I prepared for Sunday. Sundays I sometimes taught Sunday school and preached two services. A little later I started going with Jeanette and added trips to Kitchener and back on Friday nights. After we were married, I stopped teaching, and we both went to York University. A little later, we became the foster parents of Julie, now Hoover, and Sue, now Priddle, and I was responsible for quizzing in Ontario. Some Sundays after the morning service, we loaded up the Plymouth 318 with all the quiz equipment and traveled to Stayner or to Port Hope or elsewhere in Ontario for an afternoon of quiz competition. Julie ran the machine I had invented. Sue and Jeanette were scorekeepers, and I was the quiz master. On the way home, I would get Jeanette to check Bible verses and help me brush up on my Sunday evening sermon. I remember being puzzled when my pastoral colleagues thought preaching once or twice a day was a heavy day. Now I understand perfectly. I'm no longer that young upstart with boundless energy. Pastor Adriano, my colleague in the pastoral training program in Brazil, is the one who works all night if necessary, and I'm letting him do more and more of the work.
In many ways, ours is a bad news, good news story. One piece of bad news. Ron is getting older. He can't see as well. He can't hear as well. And it takes him longer to get less done.
The good news. My dad, in long-term care at Fairview Mennonite Home, Cambridge, Ontario, is nearly 101 and still reads, thinks, and interacts meaningfully with his visitors. He finds it hard to keep straight when we are likely to return to Brazil. We don't know either, but has amazingly good health.
The bad news. While returning home on his Honda 125 from a new church start in Rondônia, almost 28 years ago, Ron fell and severed his spinal cord at T6. Beyond paraplegia, he had serious complications, including total kidney failure.
The good news, thanks to fervent prayer and the generosity of family, friends, and supporters, my kidneys returned to normal function, and I have never lacked the necessary funds for equipment or for adaptations to our home. We were able to return to Brazil and continue the work of which we were privileged to be a part.
The bad news, depending on your point of view, Brazil is considered a mature field. A World Partner sent 2010 as the target date for discontinuing World Partner's missionary work in Brazil.
The good news, because of my age and disability, we're not redeployable to some other country. So if our supporters are with us, they may let us stay a little longer.
The bad news, Ron is retired and doesn't receive a salary.
The good news, Jeanette still receives hers, and we are reimbursed for ministry expenses.
The bad news, gasoline costs $1.70 here in a liter in Brazil.
The good news, our gasoline is covered as ministry expense, our housing in Brazil is provided, and so are our utilities. The bad news,
The good news. All of our children, natural and adopted, appreciate their moral, ethical, and spiritual heritage.
The bad news, not all of them are actively involved serving the Lord in a local church. The bad news, while in Brazil, we are 6,400 kilometers from our 5 grandchildren between ages 1 and 5.
The good news, since we each had a copy of the same book, I was able to read and look at the pictures with Enzo over this distance using Skype. And we expect to see a lot of each other over the next few months. They're living upstairs and we're living in the basement.
One more quick. The bad news. Habitar Brasil is a problematic part of our city known for family breakdown, crime, drug traffic, and school dropout rate.
The good news, through the CAGI ministry, our church became involved in Habitar Brasil, literacy work, short courses that teach practical skills, and Ron's work as a chaplain in the school is making a difference.
Marcel, the leader of CAGI in Brazil, emphasized the mentality that a church must have when it considers starting a ministry in a marginalized part of town. If you're planning to start a new church and add to your membership, don't do it. The ministry must focus on the felt needs of the community. When we start with that, focus, transformation of individual lives occurs, and the mentality that predominates in the community can start to change.
Many of the ladies in the Habitar Brasil are raising their children with no help from the father or fathers of their children. And so when the children are small, they can either leave them alone or take them to where they are going to have to work if they have the necessary skills for a job. Excuse me. A few months ago, Dijonetti from our church offered a course in embroidery with ribbons to a few ladies in Habitat Brasil. She gave classes once a week for 8 weeks. The embroidery can be sewn on a tea towel. They buy sugar bags, and you can cut it and make two tea towels. And then it can be sold. And by teaching practical skills, which can be used to turn over a small profit from working out of their home, we try to help people who feel helpless and dependent for handouts to become people with enough ambition to improve their lot in life. After the course finished, I noticed that right next door, Sui Lee was really engrossed in doing some sewing. She's right next to the center of CAGI, and she was sewing these embroidery strips that she had done onto tea towels. So she was putting into practice what she had learned. Donna is another of the ladies who participated in the ribbon embroidery class. She has told me several times that she doesn't want to miss out on any course that CAGI is giving. I am supposed to be sure to let her know because she wants to participate in everything. And she's really enthusiastic about learning to read as well. She's participating in a literacy class led by Susie, who's also from another of our churches there in Jiparaná. And Susie's teaching five ladies how to read. And she gives class every day from 3 to 5 for the duration of the course. And two of the women bring their 3-year-old sons, and the one lady has 11-year-old daughter because they can't leave them at home. And so we've tried to organize volunteers to come out and help look after the children while the moms are studying. When I volunteered, I tried to use the opportunity to help the kids to know how to share and cooperate with one another and learn to use good language, and the home life of most of those in Habitat Brasil is really sad. So it's no wonder that there's a high crime rate and a lot of drug traffic.
When Jeanette and I went to Habitat Brasil school for the last time in May, we talked with some of the administrative staff and a young lady who was interested in learning how to interact with students in a useful way as a sociology volunteer. I cited the example of a 12-year-old boy who was transferred to Habitat because of fights in his former school. The principal was concerned because he was bringing knives or razors to school. In talking with him, I had read from Proverbs 1 and pointed out that arming yourself puts you in increased danger. Violence provokes violence. Though I had not been aware of the results, the school staff said that the problem had cleared up and that he had adjusted well to his new school and classmates.
More good news. We work with many wonderful Brazilian colleagues.
The bad news? Some of those we work with have disappointed us and others, negatively affecting the cause of the kingdom. In 2 Samuel 12, we find the well-known and impressive story of the prophet Nathan coming to talk to King David after David's adultery and scheme to kill Uriah, Bathsheba's husband. Nathan tells the story of a rich man and a poor man who lived in the same town. The rich man had taken the poor man's only pet lamb and killed it, to prepare a meal for a visitor instead of using one from his own flocks and herds. David burned with anger at the rich man. Let's pick up the story in 2 Samuel 12, verse 7. Then Nathan said to David, "You are the man. This is what the Lord God of Israel says. I anointed you king over Israel and delivered you from the hand of Saul. I gave you your master's house and your master's wives in your arms. I gave you the house of Israel and Judah, and if all this had been too little, I would have given you even more. Why did you despise the word of the Lord by doing what is evil in his eyes? You struck down Uriah the Hittite with the sword and took his wife to be your own. You killed him with the sword of the Ammonites. Now, therefore, the sword will never depart from your house because you despised me and took the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your own. This is what the Lord says. Out of your own household I will bring calamity upon you." Verse 12. "You did it in secret, but I will do this thing in broad daylight before all Israel." We know that David repented and that his overall story is that of a man after God's own heart. But the point I want to make from this story is that in the final analysis, we have no real privacy. The things we do, presumably in secret, have far-reaching consequences. Our Brazilian son, Roberto, once hinted that he was planning to sell his vote at election time. When I tried to discourage him, he said, "You won't even know if I do or if I don't." I'm not sure what I said at the moment, but later I thought, there are two people who observe all that we do, God and Satan. Both have their ways of making use of the information. When we honor the Lord with our actions and our intentions, he brings good results in eternal terms. The rewards may be deferred, but are not lost or forgotten. On the other hand, Satan likes nothing better than to wreak havoc with our secret sins. The havoc can affect the whole church. A Bible college student whom I shall call João spent 11 months as a pastoral intern in our home in 1988. He came to us highly recommended by Bethany Fellowship's Bible College and proved himself to be a young man with a fervent prayer life and a gift for preaching. The few members of the daughter church being planted in our church at that time wanted him to be their future pastor. Jeanette and I attended João's graduation from Bible College a year later in December 89, and were guests at his wedding the next day. The daughter congregation was disappointed when he decided to serve as an assistant pastor and get some pastoral experience before possibly coming to Jiparaná. 3 years later, João contacted me about coming to the daughter congregation in our city, where I was the pastor of the church at that time, with about 50 members. It was the church, a beautiful church, that was built by a work team from Canada and finished by the National Church, and classrooms were built beside it. We were all delighted. In November 93, John became the pastor of the, and during the next year, he became an ordained minister in the IMUB, a sister denomination to the EMCC. The church grew rapidly. There were conversions almost every week and baptisms many times a year. By 1996, the space that accommodated about 250 people in the church built by the work team was too small, and expansion plans were made. Since it was impossible by neighboring land, the only solution was to go to two floors, filling the entire lot of 20 by 30 meters. In 10 years, the membership had reached 822, counting the members at the two daughter congregations meeting in their own church buildings. João became the district superintendent during two different two-year terms and was admired across the denomination. Plans were being made to amalgamate the mother church and its congregations into the daughter church so as to have all the congregations led by Pastor João and administered by a single presbytery. Is it any wonder that the enemy was looking for gaps, places he could penetrate and wreak havoc. Brazil is always looking for a savior, someone successful who has the answer, soon gets a host of followers, and is questioned by hardly anyone. Behind the scenes, secret things were happening. Jean's wife managed the church's finances, and the account keeping was not transparent nor honest. An attractive lady member of the church insisted on coming to Joan for counseling and would not hear of receiving counseling from anyone else. Neither Pastor Joan nor his wife seemed to know what was going on in the other's sphere of ministry. It was shocking to everyone concerned when Pastor Joan and his wife began talking about leaving Jiparaná and assuming a pastorate in another part of Brazil. An opportunity presented itself and they moved quite suddenly, but tried to keep control of the church in Jiparaná through people they had made responsible for finances and ministry. They had initial apparent success in the city far from Jiparaná, but the two-pronged attack of the enemy, goading them into wrong behavior while accusing them of their secret sins, was destroying them morally and spiritually. A series of events led Pastor João and his wife to returning to Jiparaná, confessing their sins to the leadership of the district, and then to the local church leaders, and then to the members of the church that they had led so effectively for 13 years. Almost everyone would have been delighted to forgive and forget. But through examination of the situation by the president of the IMUB and the general board, a different conclusion was reached. The piecemeal way the conversation was made,
the confession was made,
brought on by the fact that information was starting to leak out, created a Watergate that completely destroyed the credibility of Pastor João. In the end, his name was excluded from the list of pastors in the IMUB and from membership in the denomination. You can probably imagine the effect of all of this had on the hundreds of people who were led to the Lord and baptized by Pastor João, and especially on the team of pastors in training that he had left behind. Membership in the churches fell by about 30%, and the pastor he put in charge also left the denomination, causing another cycle of confusion and discouragement by those who remained. How about some more good news? Evangelical Christianity is sweeping across Brazil. If current trends continue, up to 50% of Brazilians might be evangelicals in 15 or 20 years. At the general conference of the IMU, in 2009, CBIN, our pastoral training program in the Northwest District, was asked to take the lead in developing a training program for the entire denomination. Adriano and I have worked together since 2002 to develop a course of studies that can be completed in 3 years by those who can dedicate 15 hours per week to classes and homework. All of our courses are in constant revision and improvement. Early this year, I taught one of Adriano's courses in Jiparaná, and he taught one of mine in Ariquemes. And both of us had trouble using the other one's material. The experience highlights what we already knew, that if our material is to be effective in the hands of others, it must be standardized, clarified, and complemented with audiovisual material. I'd like to have some of the expertise of this church for some of that job. Adriano graduated from Bible College in 2001. He graduates from university this year. A great need and open door of opportunity stands before us. The leadership is already in Adriano's hands, but he cannot do the job adequately alone. A graduate of the program, who we hoped would become a full partner on the team, had to be dismissed late last year when moral issues led to his own family's disintegration. I'm not up to what I was able to contribute in the past, but I believe Jeanette and I still can make an important contribution.
The bad news. Some of the evangelical movement that is sweeping Brazil is so badly contaminated with an animist worldview that it hardly falls within biblical theism at all. During the most recent March to May trimester in Sibim, our pastoral training program there in Jiparaná, I had the privilege of teaching a course called World View and the Mission of the Church in the 21st Century. It's really the course that Krista, our daughter, taught, but since she wasn't there, I inherited the position. The course emphasizes that we all profess, that we all process reality through the colored glasses of our worldview. There are many variations of worldviews, but we try to learn to distinguish between the three main worldviews that dominate most of today's world: animism, secularism, and biblical theism. Animism is the worldview, sees the world as one in which unseen forces present in everything from the heavenly bodies to trees, rocks, rivers, control what happens. If we live or die, enjoy health or suffer sickness, prosper or live in poverty, it is these spiritual forces that determine our fate. There's nothing much most humans can do. However, there are people who know some of the secrets of how to manipulate these spiritual forces. Through the manipulation of these forces, it may be possible to improve our fate. Secularism is much better understood in North America. A true secularist believes that all phenomena are adequately explained by scientifically discoverable physical and chemical forces and interactions, some of which may still not have been discovered. There's no need at all for anything that is supernatural. Biblical theism is the golden mean between the two. God and Satan, angels and demons, good and bad spiritual entities exist and influence human history. However, God made humans to be his co-creators and to utilize the physical universe he created and placed at our disposal. God is sovereign, but we are responsible for our decisions and action, and what we decide and do has consequences. All evangelicals, of course, are biblical theists, especially all the members of the Evangelical Missionary Church of Canada or the United Missionary Church of Brazil, aren't they? As the main assignment of the course, the students were assigned to visit another one of the evangelical churches in our city. And I chose where they would go, and I chose churches that were really fast-growing. And what they had to do is they had to go and visit a service and note everything that went on, look at everything, note everything, how they were treated, what was said, and everything. Then when they came back, they had to take all of this information and analyze it. Analyze it and think about what kind of worldview that they had seen in this church. It was really an interesting time. We had them come back and they gave their reports. And several students reported rampant animism and nothing or almost nothing of a biblical theist worldview. That was really shocking to me. But if you pay the required price, this is from one of the churches, your name will be added to a list that will be taken to the Sinai Peninsula, where the children of Israel wandered before they entered the Promised Land, and your life will be drastically changed for the better because they'll pray over it there. How can we manipulate God to get what we want? If I give X amount of dollars, then God will have to bless me. Up to 50% of Brazilians may be evangelicals in 15 to 20 years. What kind of evangelicals?
What can we do to deal with the danger in our own IMUB? In Brazil, we must take into account the thirst for a savior that has the answers and gets results. The fatalism that believes that you can't get killed until your number comes up, no matter how dangerously you live. And when it happens, it really wasn't your fault. The appeal of the so-called gospel, that if you do the right thing spiritually, i.e. go to the front and become a crente, a believer, all your problems will be solved. I believe the only viable answer is good leadership training. When we started this most recent year, I was shocked and surprised by the number of students that we had. We've usually had 15 or so students. I ended up with 31, 27 of which finished the first semester, at least in some of the courses. Not everybody does all of the courses. What had happened was that in 2008 we had a graduation, and from that graduation there were a couple of students from other evangelical denominations in our church, and they started spreading the word, and so we had a lot of new candidates from other churches. There are many evangelical churches in our denomination. So we feel
in our city.
So we feel that we have a wonderful opportunity to serve our city, and now with the invitation from the National Church to prepare a training program that will be used across the denomination, we just feel as though we have a tremendously important and a wonderful opportunity. It depends far more on Adriano than on myself. Please pray for Adriano. He is an exceptionally capable and hardworking person, but to organize all that needs to be organized for things to go as the denomination needs is going to be a tremendous job. And we hope to be able to be working with him for a little bit longer.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ron and Jeanette. And we're going to ask for the help to come and...